Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. A quorum has been established. And our first motion will be to approve the minutes of April 28th. Representative Schultz, have you had a chance to look at the minutes of April 28th?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have had the chance to review the minutes, and I would move the adoption of the minutes from Tuesday, April 28th.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendments, approving the amendments of April 28th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion carries. Minutes are adopted. So, members, this is our last hearing, and it has been an eventful 2 years, to say the very least. And before we launch into today's wrap-up discussion, I first want to thank our incredible committee staff who have done heroic work for our teams and for the committee as a whole and for the state of Minnesota. So first I would like to thank on our side the partisan staff, Curtis Peterson, Will, and Lori Kusinoff, thank you. And on the Democrat side, Benji, Molly, and Jonathan, thank you so much. But most importantly, we want to thank our nonpartisan staff who have been incredible. And we can't thank you enough, Ben. Your ability to juggle so many things and provide expert advice in real time, every day in committee and behind the scenes has been incredible, and we're very grateful for your work with our committee. So I'm sure Lee Pinto would like to also thank the staff, and also I want to thank the pages. So our pages are Ben and Liz, and they have been amazing, and we're very grateful for your help. And also, I want to thank House IT and media who has been here with us all along the way. So with that, Lee Pinto, did you have any comments?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, no, I'll just always a good idea to thank the folks who are working with us, and we're really grateful to them for their efforts. And we've had several folks on the DFL side who kind of have helped with the committee at different times through the year with the current team of Benji Brinks and Molly Peterson, and very grateful to them and to all. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So, members, before we bring the testifiers up, I just wanted to give some sort of roundup perspective, shall we say, about the work that we have done in the last 2 years. We have had multiple hearings, not only during session, but the committee kept meeting monthly in the interim last year. And we have covered a number of topics, including Medicaid fraud in the areas of non-emergency medical transportation, adult day services, assisted living, autism centers, integrated community supports, housing stabilization, feeding our future, and child care assistance. But we also had hearings with the Attorney General discussing both the role of his office in Medicaid fraud, and then separately a hearing about recording that he was made, an audio recording of him. And we also had the Secretary of State in to talk about election fraud and the security of our voting system. And then twice, last year and this year, we heard the governor's fraud package in both hearings. We had the governor's Director of Program Integrity, Judge O'Malley. And we did a hearing focused on charter school concerns that was suggested by our DFL colleagues. So we have covered the waterfront, members. And it has been eye-opening for me, and I think for all of our members, and also for the public. So I think the role of having a broad oversight committee has served the institution well, and I hope that future legislators will continue to have an oversight committee, because I do think it's important for this body. With that being said, just 1 week ago today, we were here and learning more about child care fraud while the federal government was raiding 22 sites, some autism, some child care, for more concerns about fraud with search warrants. And I just think it's very important to highlight that. We have been doing this work for 2 years. Prior to our committee existing, there were multiple years of OLA reports, of whistleblowers, of investigative journalism. And yet, in real time, a week ago, we were still seeing FBI raids. So as much as I'm proud of the work we have done, there is a lot of work left to do. And we, as a legislature and the governor's administration, we all have to continue to focus on fraud, to not tolerate fraud, to hold people accountable in agencies and criminals accountable through the judicial process. This work is not going away just because the committee will no longer be meeting. And so I implore all of us to continue to keep working on the research, the bringing things to our federal partners' attention and BCA as well. We have to keep fighting fraud, even though the committee is not going to be present or publicly holding hearings anymore. So with that, I just wanted to say why we're doing today's hearing. So we, every hearing, it felt like we ran out of time. And I know as chair, that's mostly my fault, not managing the clock well. But we've had really good, important discussions. But I felt like many hearings, we left feeling like we had so many questions left to ask, both of the agencies and of the different testifiers who had been before us. And so for today, we had invited people from the commissioner or to their department heads from MDE, Department of Human Services, and Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And originally, as many people know in the public, this hearing was scheduled for 1 o'clock today, which was our normal hearing time. But when we heard from the agencies, they responded that they couldn't possibly come at 1 o'clock today because they were going to be in Ways and Means, which I understand. This is a tough time, right? So Representative Nash was also just in Ways and Means. And so we said, of course, we will try to accommodate your schedule. We will move the hearing till 3 o'clock. We knew they were in the building because they were just at Ways and Means, but they all still declined to come. And I cannot express how frustrated and disappointed I am at that response. The agencies, to their credit, they have shown up many times, but they should be here to finish answering questions at our last hearing. And they were literally in the building. And we accommodated their request to move the hearing. So I'm very disappointed that agency officials are not with us today to answer questions. And yes, Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And to that point, I'll point out that I went to Ways and Means, did the full docket of Ways and Means, had time to walk back to my office to get a couple of things that I needed for today. Had a couple of quick meetings, one with the speaker, grabbed my water bottle, grabbed my stuff, walked back over, and here I am. So I'm curious. And I also saw Commissioner Campbell walking in the tunnel. So everybody had ample time to be here. I'm just curious as to why they're, you know, not.
Yes. So I appreciate that, Representative Nash. And I will just say, as I do almost every hearing, we will be following up with additional questions for the agencies. I've lost count of the number of letters I've sent to the agencies with requests that they have not responded to. So when they say, oh, we've been there, we've testified, we've responded to everything, in fact, they have not. And I have many outstanding requests to the agencies that I'm still waiting on. So we will obviously do that again at the end of today. But we also wanted to bring back some of the whistleblowers who have given incredible testimony, shown incredible courage, and speak on behalf of hundreds of other whistleblowers that I hear from. And so I am very grateful to the whistleblowers who were willing to take time out of their schedules to come back and finish answering questions for us. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. So with that, members, we're gonna take testimony from Nathaniel Olson, who had first signed up. And if Nathaniel would like to come to the testifier table, you'll have 2 minutes to share. Nathaniel's been in committee before, and he has been advocating for people with disabilities, and this is our final hearing, and he asked to present one more time. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Nathaniel M. Olson, the disability advocate for the state of Minnesota, and it's our last hearing. As we wrap up the session of the Minnesota Legislature, I want to reflect on the challenges we have faced and the unfortunate lack of progress. Sadly, Minnesota seems always to find someone to blame, most recently President Trump. I have done everything within my power as a disability advocate for Minnesota, but the reality of fraud in our systems remains undressed. Under Governor Walz, my efforts to expose fraud were met with indifference. Stands as proof that whistleblowers are ignored seriously and fraud is dismissed. Governor Walz chose to turn his head away from those raising concerns, and not a single Democrat has stepped up to tackle the issue. It's disheartening to witness this attitude, not only here, but across the nation. Despite this, I come here every day, hoping to bring attention to the issue of fraud, which is far more prevalent in Minnesota than many are willing to admit. Having lived in Minnesota for 26 years, I've never imagined my two-year career with a disability would end so abruptly. Speaking out as a whistleblower and advocating for people like myself led to retaliation, not the freedom of speech assumed that I was protected. Governor Walz's system is not for the people, and his actions have betrayed the trust of Minnesotans. As I say goodbye to the state I once loved, I hope that in 2026, voters will choose the truth over lies. I hope another disability advocate will step up and to carry this message forward as I move to serve the United States as a whole. Minnesota has been the great state, but protection and dignity of my people with disabilities remains lacking. Abuse, bullying, and neglect persist. As ICS homes care more about profit than people, fraud and exploitation can't be allowed to continue. We must demand accountability to protect the vulnerable. Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and committee members for allowing me to speak. Even if my presence is unwelcome, I leave with a clear conscience, knowing I felt that I fought for the truth. The truth will set me free. You're truly Nathaniel M. Olson, a former disability advocate for the state of Minnesota and now the United States. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. We appreciate you coming. So next up, I would like to invite Jay Swanson and Faye Bernstein to the testifier table. And Scott Stillman is joining us online via Zoom. And then I also want to say great thanks to the legislative auditor, Judy Randall, who is in the audience and is willing to take questions. And she and her team have been incredible partners long before this committee formed. They have been doing the work of bringing accountability and focusing on how we need to strengthen internal controls across state government. And we are very grateful, Auditor Randall, for your team, for your work, for your leadership, and we look forward to continuing to work with you. So with that, rather than have presentations from our testifiers, I thought we'd dive right into the questions. And when you are asked a question, please just state your name for the record and remind the committee and the public what your role has been at the department, just so everyone remembers. And I'll start. I have 4 pages of questions, but I'm going to try and keep myself under control here. And with that, I would like to talk to address my first question to Ms. Bernstein. So when you and I first talked, which was many, many months ago, we had a conversation about all of the different hotlines and tip lines at DHS and how they're staffed, how they function. And I just wondered, for the sake of how we are going to improve that system of reporting and tip lines in the future, if you could just talk briefly about what they are, how they're staffed, who takes the tip once they come in, how are they logged? If you could just reflect on that for a couple minutes, Ms. Bernstein.
Yes, Faye Bernstein, currently working at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We have probably 2 major tip lines. I have to say we probably have too many tip lines. It just makes it hard for both employees and the public to know where to call. But we have 2 main tip lines that we would use, one within the OIG and one within central office. The one within central office is more often used by employees, I would say. Then there is also many other emails that are published, and they will be dedicated to a specific thing. For instance, there could be one in the behavioral health division that is specifically for questions about a new service we're operating or something like that. And we, especially on the two major tip lines, but also on the others, we log them. I guess let me retract what I said. On those smaller tip lines, I don't believe we do log those. I think we just answer them as they come in. On the two major tip lines, the one at the OIG and then one in central office, those are logged, and there's some basic data points that are kept on them before they are sent off to where they go, where they need to go for investigation. That is something that the logging has always been a little, that sort of bothered me, because the one group of whistleblowers that has the Twitter account, it's always bothered me that we do not log their information, and that really makes no sense to me. I don't know why we don't. I think it sends a, I've asked many, many times that why don't we log those and why don't we keep data points on those? And the response is basically that we don't want to encourage anonymous reports like that, which to me says we don't want to encourage whistleblowers. So we're really missing a great deal of information that our whistleblowers are giving us. And it sends a very bad message, certainly to them. They feel very disrespected. I don't know why they would ever speak directly to DHS auditing staff, because they've been very, very disrespected by just being written off as if nothing they say matters. And here, I read very closely what they say, and I know the media reads very closely what they say, but DHS ignores them.
Thank you. And one additional question I wanted to ask you on this. So I've heard this from a few whistleblowers, not to be named, but I have heard that there have been whistleblower reports to these tip lines where female recipients are saying they are being pressured for sexual favors in order to maintain housing in particular, but other services as well. Have you seen or heard reports like this, and what has happened to those reports? Have they been investigated?
Yeah, I ran into those when I was doing redactions of documents. Somebody, I think it's a media outlet, has a data request into us for all of the emails that came into the HSS Housing Supports and Services Program email address. And I don't want to call that a tip line, because a lot of what came in there was just general questions. How do I qualify for the service? How do I apply? But so they were very uninteresting. But then there, I did come across some, and I, whenever I think of this, the word that just comes to my mind is, it's really gross. It is kind of gross to talk about here. But yes, there would be women, I would look at the names, and it would be a woman's name, and saying, using the one I remember particularly used the term sexual harassment. Another one was more detailed about being asked by a housing provider for sex in exchange for the service. And then I would look at what our response was, because some of the people that were monitoring that email address were licensed. And when you're licensed, you have to report something like this as a sexual abuse and maltreatment report. You have to advance that. And instead, we would respond with a form letter in the email version that would direct them to various state agencies where, because we said we did not handle complaints of that sort, and so we would refer them to other agencies where they could seek help, I guess, which is completely incorrect. The Department of Human Services absolutely investigates allegations of sexual abuse. I did that as my first job at the Department of Human Services. Licensed professionals can absolutely not ignore those reports. And it is just, it's how we handled that is so gross to me that we were leaving people in that situation. You know, when you're in that situation, you are extremely vulnerable, and you may do whatever you need to do for housing. And it is just gross that we sent them back a form letter.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question for Mr. Swanson. So I think it was yesterday or the day before, I saw on one of the news stations had a story about daycare centers and how hard it was to comply. They were essentially interviewing someone that ran a daycare center, and they talked about how it was a lot of work and paperwork to comply, and they were talking about how they send in the forms and fill it out, and the daycare owner essentially said, I don't know how people could screw this up. If you do it, it's pretty laid out. So yet we know that there's been huge fraud in daycare, in daycares out there, and the two don't mix. I mean, it doesn't make sense unless you have legitimate daycare centers that are doing all this paperwork correctly, you know, out compliance, and then the other fraudulent daycares aren't doing anything and no one is checking anything. Do you have any insight on this?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, my name is Jay Swanson. And
I'm
a retired DHS employee for about 7 years, and I was the manager of recipient and child care provider investigations up until I retired. In response to your question, I didn't think it was ever terribly complicated. In the CCAP program, providers were required to have someone log the child's name and the time that they arrived at the center, and they had to log the time that the child left the center. My kids were in daycare years and years ago, and we had to do that, and I know many parents across Minnesota who bring their kids to daycare have to do something like that. I never thought it was terribly complicated. What we were seeing from the fraudulent providers is that oftentimes either no kids were coming to the center, or sometimes kids would come for part of a day, sometimes 15 minutes. They would walk in and sign in, and their parents would walk out with them. So there was kind of a variety of circumstances that we were dealing with. And again, sometimes the daycare center was closed for the day for whatever reason. No staff was there, and no parents or children showed up. But when it came time to do the billing every 2 weeks, sometimes those fraudulent centers, you know, sometimes it billed for 50 or 70 kids when there was no staff or children at the center the entire day. Now, if that makes things complicated, well, so be it. But I thought it was a fairly simple process.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. It seems that way. I was just wondering, how can I'm just floored by the fact that we have all these fraudulent centers that literally are, I think, falsifying records, you know, and there's lots of them, and that no one caught this. And you were an investigator. How did DHS catch any of it? How did they look? Did they look?
So,
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, All of our investigations started with a tip or a lead or a complaint, or somehow we received information that something very strange was going on at this child care center. And then usually we would send investigators out. They would be in plain clothes and in unmarked cars. They would do physical surveillance of the child care center for a period of time. We would do electronic surveillance of the child care center for a period of time, and we'd try to determine are kids going to the center and being cared for? Are the attendance records and the billing records accurate based on what our surveillance showed? And we could tell pretty quickly whether or not this was a significant fraud problem or not.
Okay. Thank you. Just one more follow-up. So how did, tell me again how DHS essentially shut down or stopped you, your division, from dealing with this. What happened?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, in roughly mid-2017, I started to notice a change, that there was pushback, on us initiating and completing child care investigations. And then in the second half of 2018, when the OLA was doing its special review of child care, and I was answering questions posed to me by the OLA in an email, and the document that I wrote and forwarded to my superiors, they didn't want that document going to the OLA because what they told me was this is going to make us look bad. And then I refused to make changes to the document. And I said, if you want to send a different answer to the OLA, feel free, but take my name off it. But if my name is going to be on a response, it's going to be the document that I prepared. From that point on, it was almost like all-out war, with the upper echelon of DHS focused on shutting down child care provider investigations. And it was done, I talked about them spending $90,000 on a consultant to discredit our allegations. They had that continuous improvement program, which was basically a way of bullying and harassing our investigators. And they changed, the way we would do investigations, and they changed how it was decided which centers would be investigated. That was taken out of my hands and the hands of the CCAP supervisor that worked for me. Again, we had 70 years of criminal investigative experience between us. Those decisions would be made by a committee of three, two of which are DHS officials with no experience investigating financial fraud or public benefit crimes. So it was kind of a slow, what didn't seem slow at the time, but they enacted this new process, and then I retired in mid-2019. After I learned what the new system was going to be, I said, I'm not going to be a part of that. And so that system continued as, it functioned as it was designed, where they were spending as much time looking at providers receiving very little CCAP as those that received huge amounts of CCAP. And that continued, as I understand it, up until that unit was moved to Children, Youth, and Family a year ago when that department was formed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yep. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go back to Ms. Bernstein, if I could, and pick up on something that the Chair mentioned. Ms. Bernstein, you mentioned that there were allegations of sexual abuse that were reported up through that you would ostensibly then pass along to somebody further up the chain. Is that correct?
They just ended up in that mailbox, and they really went unaddressed.
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Here's the thing that is creating a problem for me, and I'll actually give credit where credit is due. Representative Pinto helped me with an issue 4 years ago regarding mandatory reporters. And for those that don't remember or don't know, I grew up as an abused kid, and a series of mandatory reporters completely failed me. Beyond description, completely failed me. And it sounds that that's what's happening here at the state of Minnesota, that anybody who is in a supervisorial role inside of your department would be a mandatory reporter. Maybe not everybody, but certainly a predominant number of people that would have seen these emails were mandatory reporters. And are you saying that those that would have received these that likely would be mandatory reporters chose to do nothing?
Ms. Bernstein.
It's always been a question whether DHS employees are mandatory reporters. I have always proceeded that we all are. I am actually not licensed as an attorney, but not as a mental health professional. I have always considered myself as an employee of the Department of Human Services that I needed to report. I need to pass on these. So I always have. Some of the people who were monitoring this email box that I was seeing were licensed. And if you're licensed, you absolutely have to. There's no question. The ones that weren't licensed, I personally still think they did have to. That's an open question. But the ones that were licensed, I cannot believe that they sent back a form letter and that they just left that person in that situation.
Mr. Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's the problem, isn't it? Is that somebody who comes to work for the state in a supervisorial role, that if they are indeed a mandatory reporter, chose to sweep it under the rug. And look, we're here mainly talking about fraud, which is apparently one of our net exports here in the state of Minnesota. But there's also incompetence or just willful dereliction of duty. And again, this is very personal to me, that we would have somebody who works for the state of Minnesota that is in a role that requires their reporting of something as heinous as sexual abuse, ignore that, sweep it under the rug, and then instruct the distribution of a form letter. And I just want, if Ms. Bernstein would confirm that was the process, Madam Chair.
Yes, Ms. Bernstein.
Yes, there was a form letter. It sent them to, it was a list of state agencies, human rights. I can't even remember the other state agencies that do not handle this. The Department of Human Services handles this.
And Representative Chair, Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the love of God, what the hell, people, that we would have people who come probably bearing their vulnerabilities and their souls to somebody who should do something with that, only to get a form letter? Let that sink in. Somebody who has been sexually abused comes to the state, raises their hand, says this happened, no investigation, and they're the lucky recipient of a form letter. Back to Ms. Bernstein, if I could, Madam Chair, last question before I get back on the list.
Representative Nash.
Because I have lots of things. Ms. Bernstein, and because I'm relatively new to the committee, but how many allegations would you say over the time that you were there have been effectively dismissed or similarly been given a different type of form letter to make them just go away?
Ms. Bernstein.
Are you speaking specifically about sexual abuse allegations?
Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. In general.
Ms. Bernstein.
In that particular email box, which I was in doing redactions for probably about 2 weeks, I saw probably 2 to 3 of the sexual abuse allegations. The other ones I saw was a tremendous amount of recipients of the service writing in to tell us that they weren't getting the service, but in fact, they were getting billed for the service. I could not even count those. There were so many lovely people who wrote in to tell us that we had a fraud problem.
Representative Nash.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I'll be done for now until I get back on the list. But an immeasurable number of people who have raised their hands following the process that our state has set forward, saying there's a problem here, and we send form letters and give a little chuck on the shoulder and say, it's going to be okay. Please be quiet and go away. That is ridiculous. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Next up, Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Swanson, my question is for you. Thank you for coming back. You had testified last week, and in your testimony, you talked about the OLA report of 2019. Specifically, if you have that in front of you, you're familiar with it, in Appendix B, on page B2 of that document, this was your statement. These investigators and agents, however, also firmly believe that the extraordinary level of weaknesses present in the internal controls of this program will allow the fraud to continue unabated or, unfortunately, possibly increase until changes are made in this area. And Mr. Swanson, my question to you is, was that one of the paragraphs that a senior DHS official ordered you to delete?
Yes, it was.
Mr. Swanson.
Yes, it was, Representative and Chair.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Now, I'd like to draw your attention to page B3 of that document, to the second paragraph, which reads, in calendar year of 2017, there were fraud concerns involving 42 of the highest paid centers. Investigators have significant fraud concerns regarding 72 of the top 100 highest paid centers. And investigators have significant fraud concerns regarding 100 of the top 150 highest paid centers. Mr. Swanson, the question is, was this a paragraph that a senior level DHS official ordered you to delete as well?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, yes, it was, although there's a typo in that paragraph, which was probably my error, but it was meant to read that in 2017 we had fraud concerns involving 42 of the 50th highest paid centers.
Thank you for clarifying. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you. And thank you. And further down on that same page, B3, we're still looking at the CCAP payments to the 50 highest paid centers in 2017 averaged over $1.5 million per center, and the average payment to the remaining 1,043 centers was a little over $135,000. Was this a part of your document that you were also ordered to delete, Mr. Swanson?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, yes, it was.
Representative Altendorf.
Mr. Swanson, was the person that ordered you to delete these sections the DHS Inspector General?
Mr. Swanson.
Representative, as I said last week, I'm happy to answer questions when they involve the identity of DHS officials. My preference would be to answer this committee's questions in a non-public setting.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Swanson, why do you think, even though you are leaving her unnamed at this point, why would she want these sections deleted? Why were you ordered to delete these from your statements?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, what I was told was these are going to make us look bad. I think that's what I was told, and I believe that to be the case.
Representative Altendorf.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Swanson, have you previously, before this report, expressed these same concerns to the DHS senior management about the disparity. And really, we're talking about 50 of the highest centers out of over 1,000 centers, which is quite alarming when we're looking at the numbers that they were receiving, and this should have been a red flag. Did you previously report it?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, repeatedly throughout, I would say, the 2017 and 2018 timeframe, I continually brought this up to officials above my level, but I was told that it's not an issue and don't worry about it.
Anything else, Representative Altendorf?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. I guess my last question just, you know, would be in summary. This is alarming. You know, you saw the red flags and you were ignored. You were told to stop and to not go down that road, not to expose that. You were told to delete it. You were ordered that by senior people in DHS, even though you've not named them. Did you see this disparity as a serious problem?
Mr. Swanson.
Chair and Representative, I thought it was a very serious problem, because if you do the math, what this amounted to is 50 out of over 1,000 child care centers, those centers were 4.5% roughly of our total child care centers in Minnesota at that time. That 4.5% of centers was eating up over 35% of the CCAP budget. And at that time, I would speak regularly with county CCAP employees, county CCAP supervisors, and they saw what they believed to be flagrant and large-scale fraud taking place at child care centers in their areas. And I'm talking, for the most part, primarily the Twin Cities area, Rochester and St. Cloud. But I was continually receiving calls from these CCAP program staff at the county level, and they were frustrated because of the huge amount of billing that some of their centers were doing. And while they had a concern about fraud, certainly their other concern was that these centers were eating up the budget, the CCAP budget, for their county. And most of these counties had wait lists of families waiting to, you know, receive approval for CCAP. Some of these counties had lengthy waiting lists, and these county human service officials, you know, they see the flagrant large-scale fraud by certain centers in their areas, and that they have to turn around and explain to, you know, the families on the wait list that, yes, you qualify for CCAP. We don't have the funding, you know, to put you on the program at this point. So it's not like it was a victimless crime. There were families in Minnesota that would qualify for the program, and they couldn't get on the program because, you know, the thieves were taking all the money.
Thank you. Just to clarify before we go on, one of the multiple whistleblowers to me have said that when the criteria for these investigations was red flags, and one of the red flags was just the large amount of billing from particular centers, that they received feedback from supervisors at DHS that just looking at the high dollar billing centers was not appropriate, and that once your unit was shut down, that no longer happened. Do you have any thoughts on that? Was that true? Were you told not to just investigate the high dollar unit providers? Could you comment on that?
Sure. When I was at DHS, you know, the high dollar billing, you know, was not the only indicator that we used to open an investigation. There were multiple indicators, but frankly, when we saw a center that opened and, you know, after a year was billing us for over $1 million, that's not a normal trajectory that we'd see from, you know, the vast majority of our child care centers. And while I was, while we had discussions with senior DHS officials in, say, the latter part of 2017 and 2018, and they would express to me that, you know, that that shouldn't be an indicator. We continued to have a disagreement, but then after we had the issue with what we were going to tell the OLA, then from that point on, you know, they made it absolutely clear that that we were going to be spending as much time looking at child care centers receiving funding on the low end as we did on providers on the high end. And frankly, my concern at that point was, you know, we were looking at the figure of 50%. If we're going to spend 50% of our time looking at centers receiving minimal CCAP funding, that means we're probably looking at centers, you know, receiving less than $100,000 a year in CCAP funding. That also meant that we were going to spend 50% less investigative resources on centers that were billing us for over $1 million. And I didn't think that that was a good use of taxpayer money.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've heard about suppressed fraud reports, the failure of leadership, and in instances, you know, directly arguing with the things that you have said, Mr. Swanson, and seeking to remove those from OLA reports. And we've seen retaliation against whistleblowers. So I commend both of you for standing or being here again in front of this committee. Ms. Bernstein, given the fact that you are still at DHS and hearing these examples, have you seen a shift in culture? Are we seeing positive steps towards program integrity from the changes within the department today?
Ms. Bernstein.
I would say generally no, I don't see a change in culture. There is still very much a need to for employees, my coworkers, to avoid the target, avoid being the target. And because once you're the target, I mean, I was officially a target 7 years ago, but I still suffer from that. I still have a job that I am drastically overpaid for. I have a very simplistic job that I'm paid too much money for because DHS has made the decision that that is in their best interest to keep me from doing real work. So, no, the damage that comes from retaliation is going to take years and years and years to undo. It really is. You can't just say, and I've heard every commissioner say, we don't tolerate retaliation. Then who am I? Then what am I? Obviously you do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you. So that's really hard to hear, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry to you, Ms. Bernstein. I'm sorry to the countless other whistleblowers within the Department of Human Services who could be under direct retaliation from this department, especially considering that the same people remain at the agency. The Senate didn't have the votes to confirm Shireen Gandhi. She was demoted. And John Connolly, the guy who's been the director of Medicaid, which has seen over $9 billion in fraud, according to the acting U.S. attorney during the Walz administration, is now the acting commissioner of that agency. No firings of top leadership. No one to be said that has been held accountable. Whistleblowers having been retaliated against. This is the story of the Walz years. So I want to thank you both for being here and helping tell the story that others would want to tell. But right now, I know in the room we have Mr. David Hoke, and I'd love to hear from him if he could come to the desk. So as you know, Mr. Hoke was...
Representative Schultz, just a minute. Okay, please welcome to the committee, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just highlight, and I'm sure Mr. Hoke will introduce himself as well, but I'll just highlight that he is his own independent investigator, someone who's been boots on the ground here in the Twin Cities and likely across the state too, investigating the concerns around fraud. That has resulted in part in this being told on a nationwide basis. So to you, Mr. Hoke, based upon your work, my first question for you is, following your concerns being made so public in videos, did the Department of Human Services or the Department of Children, Youth, and Families ever reach out to you to follow up on your claims of fraud?
No.
Mr. Hoke, please state your name for the record and then respond.
My name is David Hoke, lifelong Minnesotan. DHS has never reached out to me, despite the fact that I invited DHS as a whole and Shireen Gandhi to meet with me to clarify that perhaps I was wrong in my investigation and in my data.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, and as has been portrayed, DCYF claimed that they investigated the daycares that you reported on last December and said that they were all functioning normally. We just had Commissioner Brown in front of us last week. She said it to the media and offered no additional information to us in front of this committee last week. But then, following the video, a month later, the owner of one of the daycares you exposed was arrested while trying to flee the country as part of the Feeding Our Future scandal. And as we are all very well aware, last week, another one of the daycares that you reported on was raided by federal law enforcement. Mr. Hoke, do you believe, and do you think that the department, the agency, do you believe that they missed some of the red flags?
Mr. Hoke.
I don't believe they missed them. I believe that they were 100% complicit in allowing the fraud to continue.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hoke, I think that that's why it's incredibly frustrating why there have been no people fired by this governor, by Tim Walz, that he has failed to protect taxpayer money, that he has failed to hold his agency accountable. It's one reason why we need the Fraud Isn't Free Act. So, Mr. Hoke, your work, it brought so much attention to fraud here in Minnesota. No one has done it more than you have. That the Department of Human Services established an entire webpage attempting to debunk you and your work, including the statement, showing up with a camera and the goal of getting YouTube views isn't the same as conducting legitimate fraud investigations. So, were you trying to conduct a criminal investigation, expose blatant red flags and problematic providers that DHS allows to continue to bill the state?
Mr. Hoke.
So when a person is elected to office in the state of Minnesota, there's something they have to do before they're officially recognized in their new position. They have to take an oath of office. And that oath of office is designed to represent the people of Minnesota and protect and defend the people of Minnesota against this very thing. And when someone knowingly and willingly violates their oath of office, that makes them a traitor to the United States. And in my second video, what did I say? I pointed to the camera and I told Tim Walz, I'm coming for you, and told the Department of Human Services, I'm coming for you. And what's happened since? Governor Walz announced he's not running for re-election. Now Gandhi got the boot. And I'm telling you that you better hope that I don't set my sights on you, because especially if you're on this committee, the people want to know, what are you going to do to stop this fraud? Not that guy over there or that woman over there or somebody over there. You're on the fraud committee, for God's sakes. Tell the people what you're going to do individually to stop this fraud today, not next week, not a month from now, not another hearing. Tell them today what you are going to do to stop this fraud.
Anything further, Representative Schultz?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you,
okay,
Mr.
Last
Hoke.
One.
And I will just note for the record that it has taken a lot of the work of investigative journalists and the media, the legacy media, many of which are in the room, to help tell this story that agencies and the departments have failed to do. They failed to do their job. And, oh, by the way, they're all being paid. They're being paid to do that job. Being paid to protect the taxpayers' resources, and they're not doing it. So it's become routine for this level of failure, this level of fraud. And you're right. Minnesotans are rightly outraged by this. But thanks to the work of the three of you at this table and countless others, this story has never been bigger, and it has led to a nationwide effort to combat fraud that I don't think has ever taken place in the history of our country. And we're starting here in Minnesota. We are starting to clean up the mess in Minnesota. And when the FBI raids 22 facilities last week, that is only the tip of the iceberg, specifically on Medicaid fraud. And there is so much more to go. We can't prosecute our way out of it. But through our work in the legislature, through hopefully the work of Vice Chair Anderson's OIG proposal, and through our continued attention to this matter, we can protect taxpayer money for decades and generations to come. Thank you all.
Thank you, Representative Eltendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to reiterate, Mr. Hoke, thank you sincerely for what you did to help expose the fraud and to bring national attention to this in Minnesota. I sit on the Children's and Families committee meeting. You said you want solutions here in Minnesota. Everyone wants solutions here in Minnesota. I can tell you that when we, the Republicans, have brought up bills about addressing daycare fraud, we were stopped. And the Democrats literally said, alleged fraud, alleged. The rest of the country is well aware that there's daycare fraud in Minnesota, apparently, except for many of the people in the other party here. But Mr. Hoke, my question to you specifically is, are you a professionally trained investigator, number one? Number two, the information that you had for going to these daycare centers, was it publicly accessible to anyone?
Mr. Hoke.
The answer is no, I'm not a professional investigator. I work in the construction industry. I have for the last 42 years. I work full time. Everything I did was on my own. I wasn't paid for any of it. I wasn't looking for YouTube views or any popularity or any fame. In fact, I've been called a racist, an Islamophobe, every name under the sun. But the reality is my target was never the fraudulent childcare facilities. It was the Department of Human Services for funding the fraud and allowing the fraud to go on. Like I said in front of Secretary Bessent's Fraud Committee roundtable, if you put your hand out and someone puts $100 in it, you're going to stick your hand out again. You got to stop giving out the money. You got to get out there and go look at these places. And when there are seven healthcare places registered at one address, for God's sakes, aren't you looking at it and going, wait, something isn't right here? Get out and go look at the facility. Hire somebody to go out there and physically inspect these areas and say, this is a liquor store. It's a wire service. You saw the video. I could have gone to 100 of them. They don't exist. They're mailboxes. They're phantom companies. And the state keeps writing the check. And people are tired of it. I'm hearing from people not only around the country, but around the whole world now that are seeing the same types of fraud. And it's all pinned back to Minneapolis. We're the laughingstock of the entire world right now because of this fraud. People should be ashamed. If you're elected in office, you should be out front screaming fraud every single day. And the people of Minnesota should be out front with torches and pitchforks showing their anger because they vent on me and they want me to come and do exactly what I'm doing because they would all like to sit here and do this very same thing.
Thank you, Mr. Hoke. And I just want to say for the record that our staff in the interim did go and also look at a number of these places and had a similar experience of finding multiple places registered at the same address, no sign of anyone. So we on the committee did do our own work last summer, actually, and we had a similar experience, and I know other people who have looked into this, and the investigative journalists have as well. Very quickly, Mr. Hoke.
Madam Chair, so sort of the elephant in the room, and again, I'm not Democrat or Republican. I always get painted as right-leaning, but if you look at my history, I ran for Attorney General of Minnesota under the Resource Party banner. I was not a Democrat or Republican. If what I have said is false in any way, if any of the documentation or the numbers I put out are false, why has nobody sued me? I'm claiming these facilities are committing fraud. I'm destroying their businesses. Why aren't they suing me? They know where I live. They know who I am. Nothing. But what I can tell you is I had to put up security cameras around my house and spotlights because people were showing up my house at 1 and 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. I had to get a gun permit to protect my property, all because I took this on. And I'm not getting paid for it. I'm not an elected official. But you know what? I do it all again because it's the right thing to do. And when I die, I can die with a clear conscience that I did my best to make a difference. Can you say the same thing?
Thank you. Last one, Representative Altendorf.
Just real quick. And again, Mr. Hoke, seriously, I'm courage is contagious. And to everyone in Minnesota, I hear all the time how frustrated everyone is because this is happening. Everybody can see it. Except for there's not a complete willingness for us to go after it and to fix it. So what all of you are doing, all of you whistleblowers, are you are making the difference in Minnesota. You are the start of this snowball rolling down the hill. And this snowball is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. We are getting more whistleblowers coming forward all the time because of you. Because of each one of you coming forward. So thank you. And to the public, get in front of the snowball. If you work in DHS and you have seen this happen, get in front of the snowball and talk to the feds because we are not stopping until this fraud is eliminated in the state of Minnesota. Thank you to all of you.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. So I know Mr. Stillman is somewhere. Is he still on the video? Or on Zoom? Mr. Stillman, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay, so I wanted to go back to something Mr. Swanson had said earlier that reminded me of a video that I believe was an investigation Mr. Stillman had been involved in, but I am honestly not sure. So this video was sent to me yesterday by a whistleblower, and it was too late for them to come and be part of our last hearing. So I want to, but because Mr. Swanson brought up this issue of the counties flagging fraud years ago, and it's the same pattern. And to Representative Greenman's point, we have been looking at the same pattern for 2 years. It's high numbers of billing. It's high numbers of violations. It's facilities that are vacant or have their windows blocked out or are having way more numbers of children than they are having license for, the attendance records. I mean, this has been going on, according to the whistleblower from yesterday, since 2011 was the first time they started seeing it. And they flagged this person, some of these exact child care centers in 2011. And then they were finally prosecuted in 2015, 2016. And some of them are still not having been prosecuted. So let's play the video. And then, Mr. Stillman, I would like your reaction, or Mr. Swanson, or whoever else would care to comment. But to me, what we need to do as a committee is understand that this is not rocket science. These same red flags are the same ones we see in childcare, in feeding our future, in housing stabilization, in integrated community supports, in autism centers. Every vector of fraud, it's the same playbook. So fool me once, shame on us, or shame on you, but fool us twice or 20 million times, shame on us. We have got to recognize these signs and take immediate steps. And I do appreciate the work of the committee and the legislature to tighten internal controls. But But this has been going on since 2011, and the video is from 2015. When you're ready, Curtis. All right, we're having a couple of technical difficulties.
Did you change this?
No, I didn't.
No, you did.
Yes. I know. Thank you. All right. Well, while you keep working on it, we'll see if there's any additional questions. Otherwise, we can go to Lee Pinto for a closing. Oh, for the committee as a whole. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so, well, I wanted him to react to the video, but Mr. Stillman, I wondered, the video is in regard to the DECO case. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. It might be DECO. And this was one of the first cases, I believe, for childcare that was investigated. And I just wondered, my understanding is that the estimate of the fraud was substantial. And did you have any involvement in that case, and could you describe your involvement in it? Thank you. Mr. Stillman, state your name for the record.
My name is Scott Stillman. I was the Department of Human Services Digital Forensics Lab Supervisor. And I believe it's pronounced DECO. And I was involved with the DECO investigation. And I examined the evidence that the BCA, the Secret Service, I believe maybe possibly the FBI and Ramsey County Sheriff's Office gathered during multiple search warrants. And I'm sorry, could you tell me again what you wanted me to answer about that question?
So what were the red flags from the beginning that you and you were doing forensics and you were one of the investigators. Did you have interactions with counties reporting fraud, and what were the red flags that you got from different counties?
I was not a part of the initial investigation. The people involved were the BCA and Secret Service and Ramsey County, and they initiated the search warrants, and they had found so much evidence that they couldn't process it, so they asked me to do the processing. And when they brought it to me, I was told that the approximate amount of fraud was in the $40 million range, but it was eventually prosecuted in the $4 million range.
Thank you. And my understanding is that the defendant in this case, Yasmin Ali, her bail was set at $1 million. Is that correct?
I don't recall what her bail was set at. I do recall that she reportedly fled the country.
Yes, and the prosecution vociferously did not want the court to reduce her bail, but they did, and then she fled the country. And so this was going on for the committee, for the public, even though we can't see the video, which we will post to the committee page because it's worth watching. This is not new ground. This is the same story in childcare, in feeding our future, in all these different vectors of fraud. And we cannot allow the department to continue to turn a blind eye, to suppress information, to retaliate against whistleblowers. I mean, the dysfunction that continues to this day that allows billions of our taxpayers' dollars to be stolen and needy families and citizens to go without services is what we are desperately trying to stop. And so I appreciate all of you for doing this. And we do have another segment to get to here. So I will turn it to my colleagues for their closing comments before we move to the next section of the hearing. Or do you want to wait till after?
Madam Chair, thanks. I'll thank the testifiers for being here. My comment to you was just we want to be sure before the hearing adjourns. It sounds like you'd made sort of a overall comment at the start, and I think my colleagues and I want the chance to just make a statement at the end of the hearing. That's all, but not at the end of this segment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Kind of each of us. Yeah.
Thank you. So, is there any other questions for the testifiers? We probably have about 5-6 minutes for this. Otherwise, we can move on. Oh, there's a lady in the audience. I'm sorry. Yes, you were not on our list, but if you would like to come forward, we can give you 2 minutes. That's what the public testimony is when they're not signed up. So,
I did sign up.
Okay, well, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and share your thoughts with us.
My name is Julene Ruth Lovis-Bergerson, born and raised in Minnesota, and I am now taking off my rose-colored glasses. I am here to ask each of you, would you hand over $500,000 of an estate without an exact accounting of what that bill is for? I'm here representing a family that has exactly what has happened. We need help. It's a Medicaid, and
I'm sorry. Are you representing someone? Do you work for someone?
Excuse me.
I'm sorry. If you are representing someone, who do you work for? You have to identify.
I am representing myself. I don't work for anybody.
Okay.
I'm a friend of the family. Yeah, the mother received services, but there is absolutely no accounting. Who would turn over $500,000 without an invoice, and they can't get the information? So I am going to look in this camera, and I am going to plead to the federal leaders of this country to look into Medicaid in Minnesota, because we're giving our money to Medicaid, plus in recovery, plus the state is getting money from the federal government. And so, yeah, they're double dipping. I am convinced you're double dipping. I will go on to another fraud case, and that is with a nonprofit located in Bloomington, Minnesota. I have written proof that they were not registered with the Attorney General's office as required in statute 309.52. Every year, if they have receipts of more than $750,000, they have to provide four things: $25, a one-page form, their IRS 990, and a complete financial analysis audit by CPA firm. They did not do this from 2019 to March 4th of 2024 for their 2019 audit, and they received taxpayer money from the city, the county, the state, and the federal government through a PPP loan in 2019, forgiven in 2020.
Thank you.
I have been working with the Attorney General's office and have been ignored. I have all these, and I have a whole bag. So if anybody wants to see it, it's the cases with the police department now for fraud.
Thank you. And we appreciate you coming. And if you want to submit all of that to the mnfraud.com portal, or leave it with our staff, we will look into it.
As a resident, I have been expected to do all of the investigation. I got very lame answers back from the Attorney General's office. You do this, 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 this. I'm a resident. I don't do the investigation, and that is what I've been required to do. And I've been working on this since 2022 on my own.
Well,
I am so angry.
Well, we appreciate that you are working so hard to help your friends and your family members, and we are happy to take a look at all your documentation outside of the committee and sit down with you and learn more. Thank you.
And this is my leading document right here, which says, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. And the second greatest command is love your neighbor as yourself. And that is not what our leaders in our state have done. They have corrupted us. They have stolen from us.
Thank
you.
There
are people who are suffering.
There are, and we will be happy to work with you. Thank you for coming.
And there needs to be prosecutions.
Ma'am, we need to move on. We have another order of business. Thank you. All right. So next, I guess before closing comments, we'll go to the next order of business. Members, as you know, we have reached out to Representative Ilhan Omar on multiple occasions, inviting her to testify and inviting and requesting documents that appeared in the trial exhibit of the U.S. versus Amy Bach. Her office or her staff was named in multiple trial exhibits, and we have endeavored in multiple ways to get access to that because, as everyone knows, Representative Omar had some role, whether inadvertent or not. She passed the Meals Act in March of 2020, and that took the guardrails off the federal school nutrition program, which created the conditions for feeding our future. And so we invited her to testify about the law she passed. We invited her to testify and talk about the documents that are listed in the court case. And she has never responded to our multiple inquiries. So then we sent a letter after the hearing 2 weeks ago saying that we would like her to respond with those court exhibits by today, May 5th. Once again, she has not responded in any way to our inquiries. And so the only tool left for us as a committee, if we want to get these documents, is to issue a subpoena. We have never done this, members, in the history of this committee. We have never done this in the history of this body except for ethics investigations, and I don't do it lightly. But Representative Omar is a public servant. She had a direct involvement in creating the conditions for feeding our future, and as a representative of Minnesota, I believe it's important for the taxpayers to understand the role she played and understand the role her office played in communicating with the defendants in this case. So, under our rules, the committee is permitted by a two-thirds vote to request the issuance of a subpoena in the conduct of any investigation or activity or series of investigations or activities within the jurisdiction of the committee. Our nonpartisan staff has drafted the subpoena, which was in your packets. And with that, we would like to have a vote on subpoenaing Representative Omar for the documents in question as outlined in our letter dated April 22nd and as outlined in the subpoena, which is before you. Is there any discussion on the order of business to issue a subpoena? Yes, Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe just a process question. I gather this is maybe a motion that you're making. Seems like I can see some nodding from some of the GOP members, but I just don't know procedurally what's. Just first want to verify that.
Yes, yeah, so it's a motion for the committee to issue a subpoena to Representative Ilhan Omar regarding the items in the subpoena, which are in your packet.
And then.
So it's referenced here.
And then, Madam Chair, just a few questions for you, I guess, as the maker of the motion. It looks like this matches a letter from April 22nd, as you referenced. Was that the first request that was made for this information of from Congresswoman Omar of April 22nd, 2026?
Yes, it was the first request. We had planned to request if she appeared before the committee, but she did not. So we made the request for the trial exhibits immediately following that hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the trial exhibits, have you tried to get those trial exhibits from the court or from those involved in the case? That might be the more Since you're looking for trial exhibits, that seems like a pretty direct way to go.
Absolutely. We certainly did try. So I looked into it, and I was not able to find them. So with the help of our exemplary house librarian here at the Capitol, she looked into it. She was not able to get it online through the PACER system, so she went to the federal court to get the documents. And as she discovered, and we all now know, these court exhibits, the list of exhibits is public, but the exhibits themselves are under a protective order from the court, and that order binds the two parties. So it binds the U.S. Attorney's Office, the government, and it binds the defendant, Amy Bach, but it does not bind us as a legislature, and it does not bind Representative Omar from disclosing it. These were emails in her official capacity that we should be able to get access to regardless of the protective order by the court. We are not bound by it. She is not bound by it. So it's perfectly appropriate for us to seek them from her office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as I'm looking at the list of what you're requesting, it seems like it's coming from the trial exhibits. Maybe the last one references the trial exhibits, but a number of them reference other things as well. It looks like just item number 8, it looks like in the documents produced, we'd be confident that she would have those trial exhibits when in fact there's a protective order saying that nobody but the two parties can get them. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that they were original documents to her office, and I'm sure they're sitting on the server in her congressional office, and we should be able to get access to them.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I guess another question for you here is, maybe just one thing that I'll note for all of us is that the exhibit list lists the government counsel, lists the 4 assistant U.S. attorneys who work on Feeding Our Future. I know that 3 of those U.S. attorneys have now resigned, by all accounts because of pressure to take unethical acts by the Trump administration. That's what all the reporting has been. So they're just the one U.S. attorney left among those 4. It may be, I don't know if you've had a chance to connect with that U.S. attorney's office directly. I know earlier in the committee you had some trouble connecting with them, but have you had any luck working with the U.S. attorney's office regarding this?
So they are bound by the order, so I have not reached out to them on this, but in other areas of sharing whistleblower information, I have been working with the U.S. attorney's office, as I did when it was under acting U.S. attorney Mr. Thompson, and when he was first a U.S. attorney, and now under U.S. attorney Daniel Rosen and his team.
And then, Madam Chair, can you say again how you would use this information? I noticed the first request for this information came just a couple weeks ago. The committee's obviously been meeting since February of 2025. Sort of in what way, and this is our last meeting, I think perhaps, Madam Chair, it sounds like you're going to have one more meeting to potentially adopt a report. So how would this information be used, and what caused it to sort of show up at this time just within the last couple weeks, given that this is back from 2020?
Thank you, Lead Pinto. Yes. So as we've been meeting over the course of these many months, one of the things we've been doing is looking at the business model of fraud. And one thing we're looking for is how did this possibly happen in our state? And as we've been looking at the development of the fraud and looking for the red flags, one of the things that came to my attention earlier this year in 2026 was the existence of the Meals Act and how that led to the conditions for fraud in Feeding Our Future because it took the guardrails off. And so as I started looking into that with our staff, we came across the trial exhibits and we thought, well, it would be very helpful to understand from Representative Omar's perspective how she thought the Meals Act impacted the community, why she brought it, what communication she had with the fraudsters, because clearly in the video we played a couple weeks ago, she was very proud of the Meals Act. She showed the video, she cut the video at the Safari restaurant, which they were one of the leading convicted fraudsters in this. She had, according to the trial exhibits, multiple communications between her office and the fraudsters who have been convicted. So I think it's important for the public to know what role she and her office played, not only in passing the Meals Act, but in then communicating the information about how the guardrails are no longer in this program to the people who were later convicted of fraud. I think it's very material to our understanding how we got here. And so I will look forward to getting these documents from her. And we hope you also want to get them from her, because it will really help the public understand how this happened. And the fact that she had multiple communications with the convicted fraudsters who had also donated to her campaign and many other campaigns, she did return it once they were convicted. But I think understanding her relationship with the people who've been convicted in Feeding Our Future is essential to the public.
And Madam Chair, just one final piece on this. I feel like we've had a lot of conversation, especially on the House floor, about, in fact, from many of my Republican colleagues accusing my DFL colleagues of being too focused on actions of the federal government. It's interesting to me that with the state agencies that we're overseeing, that there's such a focus on this federal piece of legislation. I noted that a number of Republicans in Congress voted for the Meals Act. Whoever authored it in the first place, the fact is that it was something that, that passed Congress with Republican support. But it's just interesting to me that we would look into that of all, that if the one place where we're going to break all the precedents ever happened in the state legislature to go after this particular piece. I'm just, can you talk about that? I'm just trying to get my head around
yes,
that.
Yes, I didn't want to. I mean, we've been asking for this since our staff is reminding me we initially put out a request in February of 2026. And so we have been trying to get this through just requests, which is the normal course of business here in the legislature. But we have been ghosted. We have been absolutely ignored by a sitting member of Congress. And it is, as you see, the public is so angry. The public is demanding answers. And this is part of our process in getting those answers. So I very much look forward to having you join us in this effort. This can be bipartisan. We've done some good bipartisan work throughout the last 2 years. I hope we're going to finish strong on bipartisan work on the OIG bill and some other things that we still need to get across the finish line. And I would welcome your support for this effort.
Well, Madam Chair, as you led into this, you said, as you all know, we've been asking for this. Today is the first time that I'm seeing this April 22nd letter. I don't doubt that there were some requests was made in February. Heading into this, I didn't know a request had been made on April 22nd. So even if it was February, we're talking a couple months. April 22nd, we're talking a couple weeks. I will have comments about that relate to the committee as a whole that influenced my thought about the value of this information to this committee's ability to investigate anything, much less the Meals Act. I guess I'll just note, as somebody in my work outside the legislature, I work quite a bit with administrative, with all kinds of subpoenas, in particular administrative subpoenas that are really investigative subpoenas. I don't feel that we've met the standard that would apply for that here. I will note where you yourself, Madam Chair, talked about the precedent of this not being something that is ever happened in the history of the legislature. It is notable to me, as I say, that just stepping back and looking at this case, we had these U.S. attorneys who've left because of actions of the Trump administration. We know that the president and the federal administration have got no hesitation in going after political enemies and in investigating them in all sorts of ways. If there is any sort of wrongdoing by Congresswoman Omar, and in fact, if there's no wrongdoing by Congresswoman Omar, I have no doubt that the Trump administration will do all that it can with the resources that it has, even with the many U.S. attorneys who are no longer working for the Trump administration, including Joe Thompson, leading the fraud efforts, who we've been praising quite a bit, and he left in January because of the pressure from the Trump administration to act unethically and because of the actions that came from, in fact, videos referenced earlier here. So, Madam Chair, I do not see any value that comes out of this. I don't see, looking at broadly this committee, that this committee would make any decent use of information it would receive. And if there's something to be found here, or even if there's not, I have no doubt that there is plenty of federal investigative energy that would go into it. So respectfully, I would not agree to the issuance to having for the very first time in the history of the Minnesota legislature that a subpoena would be issued under these circumstances. That's not something that I would support. But I appreciate you bringing it up, and it certainly was worthy of discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate you bringing this forward for us. And it's important for Minnesotans, whether today or whether for the history of the state as we look forward. You know, this specific request and this subpoena specifically addresses a number of things related to feeding our future. And if there's anything that we've done over the last few months that I'm hoping my DFL colleagues have seen and heard, it's that the business model of fraud in Minnesota runs deep. It's industrial scale. And that is exactly what Joe Thompson said. And to that end, Chair Pinto, and to my colleagues across the aisle, this is about the people who have been involved and are defendants in feeding our future, who also gave donations to Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. And then beyond that, if you just read further in the subpoena, it talks about wanting to get the documents contained in the communications with Congresswoman Omar's former staff member, Guhad Hashi Said, who pled guilty to an offense related to the Feeding Our Future fraud scheme, and we are seeking all documents that contain communications with anyone associated with Advanced Youth Athletic Development. That's the information as presented right here in this subpoena request. But see, this is only one part of the story. When we're talking about industrial scale fraud, when we're talking about feeding our future, feeding our future is one part of the picture as it relates to what we know is to come in the fraud we've seen in Medicaid. So now we have this opportunity to use our tools here in the House of Representatives to issue this subpoena to gain a greater understanding so that we can stop the web, the industrial scale web of fraud in Minnesota. But it doesn't end there, Representative Pinto, because Congresswoman Omar's sister has been an executive with a business that it appears as though has received state and federal funding that was secured by the Congresswoman herself. In addition, in that very information with regards to the People's Center Clinic, it has been lauded and celebrated by Amy Klobuchar, including being at the opening of that recent, and not recent, 2022 ribbon cutting. So there are tons of conflicts of interest involved here. There's an investigation to be had, and this is a subpoena for the information. So do we want to be more well-informed? Do we want the information public for the media, for the investigators, for the accountability, for the people? Or do we want to refuse to use the tools that we have in our toolbox? Not from a partisan lens, but from a perspective of trying to stop the fraud and to protect taxpayers. Full stop. That's what I see as our opportunity here. And you know this better than anyone, Representative Pinto. If there's nothing to be found here, then there's no problem issuing this subpoena. So let's bring light to the darkness.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to comment? Okay. I appreciate your comments, Lead Pinto, and I appreciate everyone's work on the committee. I do think the subpoena is important. This is one of dozens, if not hundreds, of veins we are investigating. We have had hundreds of whistleblower reports. They continue to come in weekly. We, even though the committee will no longer have official hearings, we will continue to investigate these whistleblower reports and webs of fraud We are working very hard, as Lead Pinto suggested, on our majority report, which we will be meeting briefly next week to adopt, and then the minority will have an opportunity to also prepare a minority report. These things are important, members, for the public record to understand the staggering amount of fraud that Minnesota has experienced over the last 10 or more years, and that we are the canary in the coal mine. What we are finding out here in Minnesota has ripple effects for other states that are now digging into their own Medicaid problems and seeing these same red flags, these same webs of interconnected relationships and businesses and family members and fraudulent shell companies. That is what we have found. Representative Greenman, I think, was the first to talk about what's the business model of fraud. And we have seen that in spades in every vector of these crimes, whether it's the different Medicaid programs or child care or potentially SNAP, if we ever get to the bottom of that. And here's the anatomy of a crime, my friends. You enroll as a provider. You set up a location that could be real or fake. You sign up recipients that could be real or fake, and you start billing Medicaid. That's what's been going on. And then you set up a shell company or a related business, or your friend does, and then you're paying for catering services, and you're paying for janitorial services, and you're paying for other teachers. And it just expands the web. Then you use a real estate agent to buy another property. And we have demonstrated these webs, and they will be in our majority report. Then some people were paying kickbacks. Some people were trying to get people to switch to other businesses. Some people set up a protection scheme where they required people to pay $1,200 a month, as was testified last week, to be in a minority child care association. And if people didn't pay up, they were going to get targeted as being a fraudster, even when it wasn't true. This is the pattern, and this is what we're trying to get to the bottom of. And so these documents are important, and I hope our colleagues on the other side of the aisle will vote with us for transparency and accountability rather than continuing to protect the fraudsters.
Madam Chair, request a roll call. And, of course, I reject the last phrase about protecting the fraudsters. But in any case, I would just request a roll call. Thank you.
Roll call will be granted. Representative Nash, and we do have to move to vote. I promised Lee Pinto he would be out of here for a meeting, so we have to vote soon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to point out that under Minnesota Statute 3.153 requires two-thirds of a committee in order to do this, so we would require a roll call and was going to request that myself.
Yes, and two-thirds for the member of the public is we need six votes to issue this subpoena. So with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Robbins?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Lead Pinto?
No.
Representative Altendorf?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative Nash? Representative Schultz?
Aye.
The vote is 5 in favor, 3 against. The subpoena, the motion fails and the subpoena will not be issued. But I will continue to try to reach out to Representative Omar's office, and I hope she will eventually respond to us. With that, members, we'll go to closing comments.
Good, that was all I was going to ask for. Thank you so much. I think Representative Elkins was going to speak first, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, when I volunteered for this committee, mostly I was doing it because I knew it would help me open doors to explore what are some of the systemic system weaknesses that are at the root of a lot of these issues, and it has. And so I'm pleased that at this point, I mean, there's still work to be done left in this legislative session. But, one of the biggest weaknesses, almost all of the 14 high-risk programs that are at the heart of this, our investigations, are programs that are where the enrollment and eligibility is done on the ancient system called MAXIS. One of the worst weaknesses of MAXIS is that no one has ever before been able to figure out any way to do connect it electronically with any other system of any kind in order to import the kind of data that would be needed there to be able to head off some of these frauds. So I'm pleased to see that now Minute has brought in a tool that potentially can be used for that purpose. It's a market-leading tool called called Boomi. And DCYF, which is the owner of Maxis, is now testing the connection using the connection between MN Benefits and Maxis to try out the tool. And this one will be very productive because right now applicants for these programs enroll in the programs or try to enroll in the programs using DHS's MN Benefits portal. Except because there are no, it's been impossible to connect the MN Benefits portal to Maxis. What happens is that somebody at the county takes the information from Maxis, basically prints it out, and then rekeys it into Maxis. And if the applicant is applying for three programs, they have to key it in three times. So if this trial works, then the next connection that should be attempted is to the login MN application, which is what the state is going to be using going forward for identity verification and management. So the Department of Employment and Economic Development is already the guinea pig for that. It's working there. It's already heading off fraud. We're not hearing about massive fraud in the paid family and medical leave program. So it's much better designed, and they've been using this from the beginning. So, again, if we can use Boomi to connect MN Benefits to Maxis as well, it'll cut down or virtually eliminate the key vectors of fraud, which is basically making up patients or making up clients and creating false enrollments in the program. So that will address that issue. From there, we should move on to using it to take data from Deed about employment and income data in order to evaluate applications, and to the federal data sharing hub, which can be used to pull in the data needed to evaluate IRS income, citizenship, births and deaths. And so we're chipping away at this. So the plan is in motion to resolve the biggest of the problems. Eventually, we'll get around to either migrating the rest of Maxis to Mets if we can deal with the relatively minor experience we're having in Mets. But I'm just pleased to report at this point with the work that we've been doing over the last year on systems modernization, which has been bipartisan, we're beginning to make substantial progress towards resolving those issues and implementing features that are going to make it hard or impossible to do many of these kinds of frauds that we've been seeing.
Thank you, Representative Elkins, and I want to thank you for your hard work on this. I know that you have worked diligently, bipartisanly, and you have tech skills that I wish I had. So we are really grateful for your many contributions in this area, and we look forward to you continuing that work. So thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this committee definitely has been a journey we've all been on. And just to start, I think what we have learned about the business model of fraud, and whether we are talking about what happened with Feed Our Future, or Medicaid, whether we're talking about charter schools, the issues I think we should have been talking about in long-term care and in some of the treatment centers, I think the idea that we have private providers targeting government for private gain that is ripping off, most importantly, the Minnesotans who need to be served and the taxpayers who have chosen to elected people who have chosen to invest in those programs is maddening. It is infuriating. It is hard. I think you'll not hear. I am a Democrat because I believe that government and democracy can serve and be valuable in community and people's lives. And the fact that this kind of targeting of fraud, this private provider fraud, is throwing these programs into jeopardy is really hard. And it's something that we, I think, all, you're hearing it not just in this committee, but across the legislature, are focused on. So it's committee, you know, it's companies ripping off Medicaid, it's private providers defrauding CCAP, it's cheating workers in the UI Trust Fund with MISCLASS. It's hurting everybody. And I think that what this committee has done is we've spent a lot of time learning about that problem. And I feel like some of the things that was helpful in this committee, unlike, or not unlike, but that the committees of jurisdiction couldn't do is, like, we could see broad themes and trends, structural focus, right? None of us have a real background in HHS, and so, like, when we got into the nitty-gritty about how to redesign those programs, that wasn't our thing. But when we talked about some of the incentive structures and some of the structural issues that have made government vulnerable, I think that that's the place where we have actually learned something in this committee. The mal-aligned incentives, the misaligned incentives, excuse me, that when we have, let's say, government is the single payer, payer for the services, and then we have private providers. I think we have seen some real challenges in terms of misaligned incentives. When we have seen outsources of services and outsource of the oversight of those services, Feed Our Future is a perfect example. We had food aid offered through our public schools. We were not here listening to lunch ladies who committed fraud. We were talking about private providers who then were overseen by a private oversight infrastructure, which was what Feed Our Future was. That was a structural problem that we have set up. And so I think what has been hard about this committee is it feels like we missed a real opportunity to focus on some of those structural solutions. We have spent a lot of time admiring and detailing the problem, but not on the big structural solutions to root out and eliminate fraud and the vulnerabilities. So there's been a lot of work in the legislature done in the last 2 years around building bureaucracy, around hardening the target, if you will, and I think all of that in the short term is really important. The policy responses, the interventions, monitoring, adding FTEs, I actually think, like, as we think about the next couple of years and that intervention, most of those policies people are working on, and there's bipartisan support. But when we talk about stopping the business model of fraud, we actually have to also talk about changing the incentive structure, eliminating those structural vulnerabilities, and in many cases, ending the privatization that has made government a profit margin or a profit center and has made taxpayers the mark. And a few places that we could have been doing if we had been focused on this that I know I've been talking to some of our colleagues about, we could have looked at services like PCA and Medicaid waiver services where the government is the only payer and where private providers are billing the government. And we could have looked at those misaligned incentives and how to potentially, and I think we still should, for those of us who are going to be in the legislature, how do we actually redesign and reimagine that program so that we are eliminating those structural vulnerabilities? We also could have dug deeper on one of the things that I think to me just became the clearest, and I learned here, is how fragmented these systems are. So we have a federal, in Medicaid, we have a federal and state payer. The states are overseeing, their oversight is of the payment. The counties are overseeing the benefit. In many cases, they're being provided by private providers, and sometimes the county case managers are outsourced. And so you have all of these different layers that we are now, I think, trying to, in a bipartisan way, figure out how to close up those vulnerabilities, but the way to actually do it and provide these services better, and I know Representative Anderson, you and I have talked about this, is actually thinking about how do we take on that structural transformation so that we streamline the services and from the beginning start to make sure that we are closing that target. So it feels like the kind of accountability and transparency that we are talking about when we talk about the problem that we know the public is talking about does require some of these big structural transformations that we can deliver. And so instead of just tinkering at the margin, again, I think that there is some of that, and I voted for these bills, especially that the committees of jurisdiction are looking at. But we actually need to think about the system's redesign with a publicly transparent and accountable both payers and providers. And that, to me, is work that we haven't really started. And that, to me, is work that I think if we want to, in the long term, build Minnesota up and build the government and the democracy that we all, I think, have said we want to do, we want these programs to be successful, that's the transformational work I think we need to do, and we should carry into next year in whatever committee and where whatever that looks like in the future.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And I really share your desire for changing incentives, and I think that's key. And those structural reforms are essential. But first, we do have to stop the bleeding. And a lot of the internal control work we have done on a bipartisan manner to strengthen internal controls, to have prepayment reviews, to stop payment earlier when there are credible allegations of fraud, the whistleblower protection bill we passed last year, the current effort to extend the statute of limitations, all of those things are also essential, and hopefully the OIG bill getting across the finish line. But as you know, we'll always have this discussion, and I hope we'll continue to have it even once I'm no longer here. But I don't think the issue is the private providers. And I know we may fundamentally disagree, but we have hundreds, if not thousands, of wonderful, legitimate private sector providers. So it's not that there aren't great private sector providers. It's that a very small number of private sector providers have figured out the business model of fraud and have chosen that rather than chosen to provide legitimate services and take their normal profit, and instead they are fraudulently scamming the taxpayers. And so I just want to make sure that we realize that the profit motive isn't bad, that it's not private providers who are bad. Most of them are doing a fantastic job, and that it's a small group who tend to have the same red flags, where it's a small number taking up a huge percent of the budget, as we saw again today. Those are the problem actors we need to go after, not the entire system. And I know you want to respond, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, because when I say private provider fraud, what I do not mean is all private providers are fraudulent. What I do mean, and I think I'm going to go back to Skeeter Future, is that this is a structural thing that we have created, but we have not been talking about, when we talk about the county delivery of services directly, when we talk about food aid through our public schools, that is not where we have been seeing the business model of fraud. And so when we look at, and we are also not talking about recipient fraud, because that's not the place that we have experienced that. What we really, when we talk about Medicaid fraud and what we have from, you know, the whistleblower conversations to the OLA to what our agencies are saying, what we're talking about is private entities, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit, but private entities that have an incentive to make a profit. And if that profit may not be, you know, it may go back into your business if you're a nonprofit, that's a different incentive structure than government employees and then government service provision. I don't foresee a world where every service is provided by the public, but I do know that we have outsourced almost every provision and also outsourced the oversight of that provision. When we talk about MCOs, when we talk about the Feed Our Future model, where we give one big grant to an organization and then they subgrant to other providers, that is a structural incentive structure that we, the legislature, is choosing to do. So I appreciate the, and I wanted to clarify, because there are great providers, but when we look at the structure we have created, if we don't look at that structure, then we are not actually going to root out the kind of fraud that we are talking about and the way that the benefits fraud has functioned that business model.
Thank you. Yes, and I agree. Those sites that then subcontracted, you know, approved the Feeding Our Future individual sites, the site sponsors, that was a huge part of the problem. And we see that in other program areas. So hopefully that's a lesson learned from that. But also taking the guardrails off the program for income eligibility, allowing restaurants to participate, all of that happened in the Meals Act. So I do think taking the guardrails off some of these programs did set up that structure, but I totally agree. Using those multiple layers impedes accountability. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's no secret that I've had some pretty extreme frustration with the committee and the process, and I want to emphasize that it's not at all a frustration with the idea of going after fraud or preventing fraud. Fraud in our public programs is completely unacceptable. We know that there is fraud outside of our public programs. We know there's a fraud that impacts us as consumers and targets us in our private capacities. But of course, fraud in our public programs is reprehensible, especially because it's targeting taxpayers' funds and because it is targeting people who are vulnerable that we're attempting to help. And of course, we have a particular responsibility in our public programs to take care of them. So that is an absolutely high priority goal, which has led to my particular frustration with the committee. But I'm going to try to be as positive as I can about this, and want to note, and I mean, I'll ask Madam Chair with respect after the hearing is done. I've got a document that lists a lot of the anti-fraud reforms that happened in the 23-24 session or term, but also happened in the 2025 session. Every one of those last session had support from Republicans and from Democrats across a wide variety of categories. I won't get into them, but quite a few things. And there are a number of proposals advancing this session, like quite a lot. So if folks are looking at this or seeing this frustration and saying either nothing's happening or folks on my side are resisting or folks on the Republican side, to note that Chair Nash's bill about fraud risk rating, House File 3682, the Human Services Finance Bill, House File 4338, has a ton of provisions from members across both parties. Representative Norris Medicaid Fraud Control Unit funding that just passed through Ways and Means today, as did the Human Services Bill. Of course, the bill that Representative Anderson and Representative Norris working on regarding statewide OIG and IT investments, and many, many could go on. And those are just a few focused particularly on public programs. We may disagree on certain aspects of those bills, but I want to recognize that that is strong bipartisan support. I'm going to disagree that this committee played much, if any, role on any of that in 2025 or 2026. It gives me no joy to say that. I don't want to say that. That's just been where we've been at. I don't know how else to call it. I would strongly disagree. We've received many insights into specific programs in the course of this. And in fact, part of the reason that I was resisting the subpoena is the lack of confidence that it would be used, that any information we get would be used to gain actual insights. And in fact, just the opposite, that the activities in the committee have tended to prioritize, in my view, political theater and not going after fraud. Again, there's been lots of anti-fraud work happening among Republicans and Democrats in this legislature in this term. Thank you to all of us for that. I wish that was happening more in this committee. But I'm going to try to end on a positive note to say that one benefit of this committee, though I wish we'd been more connected to the actual jurisdictional areas, I think it would have helped when we look into CCAP or Human Services Program to have our Human Services or Children and Families colleagues alongside, that it be as it may. But there is an advantage, I will say, to seeing patterns across different areas. Definitely see that. And Representative Greenman referenced, we've had discussions about privatization of services. I want to note universal school meals. We haven't had the same concerns you have in Feeding Our Future. There's a publicly provided program and Feeding Our Future. The Meals Act, of course, signed by President Trump and Republicans in Congress, as I say. So I think there's a lesson there. The harms of privatizing oversight, in particular, we've talked about. And more generally, prioritizing money going out the door over accountability. And I think this is something I think my Republican colleagues would agree with me on, that very often when we set up programs, and I'm including the Housing Stabilization Services Program as an example, Republican House, Republican Senate set it up. I think a Republican member, in fact, was the author of that. A program perhaps that emphasized we want to meet a need, very understandably, and wasn't thinking enough about accountability and structure. That is a key thing we need to do. That's one thing that's very important to me. I know to all my colleagues, I would think my Republican colleagues as well. So let's take that, let's continue to run with that, and let's continue to advance the many proposals that are moving through our body and our negotiations with the Senate. Very pleased with them. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Lee Pinto. And I would just note for the record that the reason we as a committee have not heard a lot of bills is because that's not the function of an oversight committee. All of us on this committee have been working diligently on all these bills that have been going through all the different committees of jurisdiction. I've chief authored many, all of you on both sides have been authoring bills to deal with fraud. So I don't want the public to think because we don't have bill hearings, that's not the role. And that's why we have the luxury of having these deeper dives and looking across the different sectors of the enterprise. So I appreciate Representative Pinto, you expressing your frustration. And I just want to say I appreciate that, but that's not the role of an oversight committee. And I do think going forward, I hope this institution continues to have oversight committees and that we will continue this work in the future because it is necessary. The committees of jurisdiction are hearing bills all the time and they don't have time for these longer discussions. So I appreciate the hard work of everyone on the committee. Oh, very quickly, Representative Schultz. Okay, so just so people understand, next week the majority report will be available and we will meet briefly, time to be determined by staff to meet and adopt the report. It won't be a long meeting. And then the minority report will be able to be adopted on the 14th. So very quick two meetings next week, but the bulk of the work of the committee is done and I'm very grateful for everyone. Thank you. We are adjourned.